Judges 14. Samson went down to Timnah and saw there a young Philistine woman. When he returned, he said to his father and mother, "I have seen a Philistine woman in Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife." His father and mother replied, "Isn't there an acceptable woman among your relatives or among all our people? Must you go to the uncircumcised Philistines to get a wife?" But Samson said to his father, "Get her for me. She's the right one for me." His parents did not know that this was from the Lord, who was seeking an occasion to confront the Philistines. For at that time, they were ruling over Israel. Samson went down to Timnah together with his father and mother. As they approached the vineyards of Timnah, suddenly a young lion came roaring towards him. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him in power, so that he tore the lion apart with his bare hands, as he might have torn a young goat. But he told neither his father nor his mother what he had done. Then he went down and talked with the woman, and he liked her. Sometime later, when he went back to marry her, he turned aside to look at the lion's carcass. In it was a swarm of bees and some honey, which he scooped out with his hands and ate as he went along. When he rejoined his parents, he gave them some, and they ate it, and they too ate it. But he did not tell them what he had taken, where he had taken the honey from the lion's carcass. Now his father went down to see the woman, and Samson made a feast there, as was customary for bridegrooms. When he appeared, he was given 30 companions. "Let me tell you a riddle," Samson said to them. "If you can give me the answer within the 7 days of the feast, I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 sets of clothes. If you can't tell me the answer, you must give me 30 linen garments and 30 sets of clothes." "Tell us your riddle," they said. "Let's hear it." He replied, "Out of the eater, something to eat. Out of the strong, something sweet." For 3 days they could not give the answer. On the fourth day they said to Samson's wife, "Coax your husband into explaining the riddle for us, or we will burn you and your father's household to death. Did you invite us here to rob us?" Then Samson's wife threw herself on him sobbing, "You hate me. You don't really love me. You've even given my people a riddle, but you haven't told me the answer." "I haven't even explained it to my father or mother," he replied. "So why should I explain it to you?" She cried the whole 7 days of the feast. So on the seventh day, he finally told her because she continued to press him. She in turn explained the riddle to her people. Before sunset on the seventh day, the men of the town said to him, "What is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion?" Samson said to them, "If you had not ploughed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle." Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon him in power. He went down to Ashkelon, struck down 30 of their men, stripped them of their belongings, and gave them their clothes to those who had explained the riddle. Burning with anger, he went up to his father's house, and Samson's wife was given to the friend who had attended him at his wedding. I guess if most of us are honest, at times at least, we find that we're disappointed with God. You see, we see other people, and from our perspective at least, it seems that they go through life and it's just a breeze. They just saunter through life and everything's easy compared to us. They get what they want and it seems to be trouble-free. A question I've heard people raise to God, but via other people, whether it's me or someone else, is, for example, why can't we have a baby? They can when they are uncaring or the baby's unplanned or unwanted. Why is it we read the Bible and we see God cares for people and even he raises the dead, but I'm struggling with grief, maybe an unexpected, sudden death? Or, you know, someone would say, "God, we've prayed for our kids, we taught them the Bible, And this one's gone off the rails in one way or another. And when we step back, we can testify to God's goodness. We can see his hand at work at various points, but with gaps. And we sort of think, why is it? It seems that we can see God's hand here, but why is he sort of looks like he's taking it off there? At this point, remember what we looked at last week in chapter 13. We saw two things about God last week. God shows amazing grace and that he is awesome mystery. He's always gracious, but he is mysterious. His ways are beyond ours. And so we saw last week that actually God at times just leaves us bewildered. Martin Luther talked about life as a tapestry. On the one side, it's just a mess. It's just loose threads that don't seem to go anywhere and just a load of colour. But in heaven, we see the other side, where we see the beautiful picture that God was doing all the way through. But what is particularly puzzling is when you see God's hand through, say, suffering, but you can't help but ask the question, God, couldn't you have done it without the suffering? Your hand was there, why couldn't it be there in another way? For example, I heard a story through someone else I know of an elderly couple, and the wife in her late 70s decided that she wanted to learn to drive. Her husband was a bit dismissive at first, kind of, what's the point? For a start, she didn't really need to, because they did everything together, so he could drive her everywhere. And also, as we all know, the older you get, the longer it takes to drive. So what is it? They reckon it's 3 hours plus an hour and a half for every year of your life. So at 17, 18, it's going to take you about 20 hours. At 70, a while it will take you, won't it, to learn to drive. But she was very keen, so he just went, okay, she's keen, let her do it. And then just after she passed the test, he was mugged, and he was sprayed in the face with something, and it left him blind. And the couple were extremely grateful to God that she'd been given this desire to learn to drive, that she'd learned much quicker than someone in the late 70s should have been able to learn, and passed and so on, before the attack. So they were very grateful to God for that sequence of events. But why did God allow the attack? You see, you can see God's hand, but why didn't he have his hand in the other bit? Well, we saw part of the answer to that last week. He shows amazing grace, but he is an awesome mystery, and his ways are beyond us, and they leave us bewildered. And in chapter 14, it shows us that it's not only God is at times mysterious, but he also works in secret. I've used this verse before. This is great. If someone asks you a really tough question, okay, so you're a Christian. Why do you believe blah, 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 blah? Why does this happen? If you ask, there might be an answer in the Bible, but if there's not, Deuteronomy 29:29, the secret things belong to the Lord, our God, but the things revealed belong to us and to our children forever, that we may follow all the words of this law. So we're told stuff in the Bible, lots of stuff, and we're told these things so that we can know God and so we can obey him. But then there are the secret things. The secret things belong to him. God hasn't told us everything, but these secret things become clearer later, perhaps much later. And it's important that we know that. There will be gaps in what we see, but that doesn't make God untrustworthy. In fact, it's his long-established pattern. And so we need to just sometimes relax a bit. And that's what we see here in chapter 14. I'm going to say a bit about the structure of this bit of Judges. We need to see that a little bit. We've seen already that Judges has this structure. At first, we said it's like a cycle, didn't we? Do you remember they abandon God, they're handed over, they suffer, they cry out, a judge comes, and they're safe until the judge dies, and then they repeat that cycle. In fact, we said in the end it's not a cycle, but a spiral. And the spiral is now stretching, as it were, and is going down faster each time. And Samson, a bit like Gideon, is a focus on one judge. We have a few chapters on him, a little mini-series, a focus on one bit of the spiral. But Samson has his own structure as well, like his own little series that he's gone off on. So chapter 13, we saw last week, sets the tone with this amazing birth announcement. And we saw last week, didn't we, the amazing grace, awesome mystery. And that theme follows through, amazing grace, awesome mystery, follows through this Samson story. And chapter 14 and 16 expand that grace and mystery theme. And there's a sequence that's repeated in there. The sequence is this. There's strife caused by Samson on the Philistines. There's an apparent solution that they come up with to quieten him or stop him. But that ends in failure on their part. And it backfires and Philistines get killed and humiliated in the process. And that repeats a few times. So there's one cycle, which is chapter 14, we're going to look at in a second. All of chapter 14 is that cycle of Samson causes strife. They think they've come up with a way to stop him. It backfires and Philistines get killed. And then there's three cycles in chapter 15 and five cycles of it in chapter 16. But in chapter 16, the last cycle works. They actually stop him. They shave his hair, he loses his strength, and in the end he dies. But of course, in his weakness and death, in fact, he delivers the heaviest blow to the Philistines and rescues Israel. And at that point you think, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? In weakness and death, he rescues the Israelites. We'll come back to that in 2 weeks. But the emphasis in this first pattern is the emphasis on secrecy. Like all of Judges, it's expertly written and engaging, and all the way through we know what's going on. But the characters, most of the characters don't. So they are bewildered. But of course we know where it's going. We see everything coming. It's funny, like I've mentioned the other week, sometimes I've heard ministers when they do sermons and they talk about something from illustrations from opera or Greek mythology. Best example I could think of was Marvel films, like Spider-Man and the Avengers. But when you're watching them and you think, oh no, he's the baddie. But they don't know he's the baddie. But we know that and he's going to get more information. And also, then you think, oh, but you see, we know that he's Spider-Man, but they don't know he's Spider-Man yet. And that sort of thing. That's what's happening in Judges 14. We know what's going on, but none of the characters in the story know what's going on. So chapter 14 is structured around this phrase that comes up four times, Samson went down, he went down. And four times it says he went down, or Samson went down, and there's a secret. And you could say the first two secrets are God's, and the second two are Samson's. So firstly, we're going to look at God's secrets in verses 1 to 6. There are two secrets that God has, but the writer, with hindsight, knows them, and he's told us. So we know the secret straight away, but nobody else in chapter 14 does. God's two secrets are, first, his secret plan in verses 1 to 4, and second, his secret strength in verses 5 and 6. So his plan is the big secret, what these three chapters are about. And we'll come back to this in the closing verses. When Samson, we're told, I said four times, it says he went down. At the end of the chapter, he goes up. So we know the scene's finished. Now, do you remember again last week? There's Manoah and his wife, and they can't have a baby. And then God promises them a special one. Now, imagine that. Going back to last week, imagine that you're perhaps in a sort of age where it's not likely that you're going to have children. You perhaps got married at the sort of sensible age for having children. It never happened, and now it looks like it's not going to happen. And you know, you come to terms with it, and you've got over it. And then an angel comes to you and says, "You're going to have a baby." And not just you're going to have a baby, but it's going to be a Nazarite. He's never to have alcohol, he's never to have his hair cut, and he's going to deliver your people Israel. You'd be pretty excited, wouldn't you? You'd be excited that you're having a baby, that you've given up on that, and you'd be excited that this one is going to be a special one. He's a Nazarite, special, he's set apart, he's going to do wonderful things. Most parents are proud of their children, aren't they? But this would be on another level. They must have been so excited. So first, the pregnancy after having given up hope, and then the baby's first steps, and all that time, and not cutting his hair. So every time you look at him, even when he's being really naughty, you're looking at him going, he's the child of the promise. He's the one who's going to do great things for God. The Spirit will be upon him. We heard it from the angel of the Lord. So we come to chapter 14 and look at verses 1 to 4. What a disappointment he's turned out to be. What a disappointment. They must have been disappointed with themselves. What did we get wrong? Perhaps we didn't tell him off enough. Perhaps we didn't take him seriously enough. They must have been disappointed with Samson and with God. Samson has been to Timnah and he's seen a woman. And it's interesting in the Hebrew, because the word woman is emphatic. It comes at the start of the sentence. So it's like, he saw a woman. He saw this person and he was pretty struck by her. And he just goes to his dad and says, fetch. Just get me this woman. And you can feel, you can sense Manoah's disappointment. The Bible's pretty clear about marriage outside of the covenant community. We shouldn't do that. But this is a Philistine of all the people groups he could marry. These are the oppressors, the people causing Israel the problem. And it turns out that Samson actually has a real thing for Philistine women. This is not the last time he does that. And so in verse 3, the dad says, well, what about one of our own girls? But Samson is insistent. And look at his words at the end of verse 3. It's on page 258. Samson said to his father, get her for me. She's the right one for me. Or in other versions, she's right in my eyes. Which is a phrase that comes up towards the end of the book. Everyone did what's right in those days in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So remember that phrase. We'll come back to it later in a few weeks. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Samson does right by his own eyes. So she looks pretty good to me. I'll have her. He makes up his own rules. So they're saying, don't you care what God says? I don't care what God says. I don't care what you say, Dad. She looks pretty good to me. She's right in my eyes. And this is God's specific man for the job. And the parents must be thinking, what did we get wrong? You were there when the angel of the Lord came, weren't you? Well, you seem to be pretty clear about this Nazarite, he's coming to save Israel business. This is not looking right. But verse 4, and it's interesting, the NIV put this in brackets, other versions don't. And I think actually this is the main verse in the whole chapter. His parents did not know that this was from the Lord, who was seeking an occasion to confront the Philistines, for at that time they were ruling over Israel. God said he'd use Samson to start to rescue Israel from the Philistines. At no point, however, did he say how he was going to do it. And as we go through the Samson story over the next 2 weeks, we increasingly see him as a tragic, even comic character. We assume he had big muscles, I don't know, but he's very strong, amazingly strong. But he has no character. He's a weak man in many respects. And his big weaknesses, two big weaknesses, our pride and his love for Philistine women. But God's going to use these very weaknesses. So this wanting the woman from Timnah, it's wrong from Samson's point of view, it's disappointing from his parents' point of view, but it's God's plan. I come across this that someone, she said, of all my sources, this is what someone put on Facebook. Moses stuttered, Noah drank too much, Elijah was suicidal, Jonah ran from God, the disciples were narcoleptic intercessors, Timothy had ulcers, Peter denied Jesus, Paul was a murdering religious fanatic. God doesn't always pick the obvious, and today he chooses you. But this is odd, isn't it? I mean, this Samson business is odd. He's different from the others that God has used. God has not just taken a misfit and then powerfully equipped him. God has taken nothing. He took a woman who couldn't conceive, worked in her so that she could, and then he's going to use her son. But he's a bit of an odd ball, isn't he? He's not the sort of person you'd want to lead God's people. But remember God's name last week. God's name is Wonderful. He is Awesome Mystery. But Noah and his wife don't know this yet, and the Philistines certainly don't, and even Samson isn't quite yet sure about all this. It all seems very confusing to them. They think they failed. And maybe they had. Maybe his parents had got things wrong. But we don't have that information. We don't know what they were like as parents. But Samson's desire for this Philistine woman sets a chain of events into action, which ends up with him saving Israel. Some wise words I came across recently is, what we don't yet know may turn out to be our greatest comfort. What we don't yet know may turn out to be our greatest comfort. So his parents look at him and just think, what have we done wrong? And they pull their hair out. Actually, he's going to see, even in his, what he's doing wrong, God uses it. It becomes their greatest comfort. The next secret of God's is Samson, Samson himself, in God's strength. Samson is in on this quickly. God's strength comes to him in verses 5 to 6. En route to Timnah, a lion attacks Samson. And in verse 6, the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and he tears the lion to pieces. When you see a lion, if you go to Colchester Zoo, there's a couple of lions there. You look at them and, yeah, you wouldn't fancy your chances. And he just pulls it apart like it was a much smaller animal. And notice Samson's superhero strength is not him or his hair, but the Spirit of the Lord brings the strength. This is Samson's and God's secret. But notice verse 6, he didn't tell his dad. So not even his parents know. Nobody knows that. I mean, Samson, I guess he's never had his hair cut. He probably looks a bit strange. But no one knows about this phenomenal strength. But now Samson knows. And I guess there are times when God does something like that for us, not quite like that, but a little crisis, and he equips us to cope with that crisis. We have to deal with it there and then. But then we know something about God's work in us. So when the big one comes, we know what we can do in his strength. Samson now knows about this strength, and he needs to know that for a bit later. Then we have Samson's secrets in verses 7 to 18. Samson has two secrets too. The secret of the honey in verses 7 to 9, and therefore the secret of the riddle in verses 10 to 18, which in turn has another secret from his guests. So having just seen God's strength through Samson, so we've seen God has used his strength in this man Samson, now we see Samson's weakness, or one of them. First is the honey in verses 7 to 9. Again, verse 7, he went down. And again, he talks about what is right in his eyes. And in one sense, we've learned a lot. In one sense, he's learned a lot from fighting the lion. He knows that God will give him amazing physical strength when it's needed, which is going to be a bit later to fight the Philistines. But he still does what's right in his own eyes. And verse 9 ends that he still doesn't tell his parents. He doesn't tell anyone. Only Samson knows about the honey. Only Samson and, of course, us. We know. But no one else knows yet. And we take that secret with us as we read the next bit from verse 10, when we go to the wedding feast. And the ancient Near East weddings had lots of feasts, 7 days of feasting. It's like a stag night, a hen night, a rehearsal. That's an American thing. They do a rehearsal, then they have a meal a few days before the wedding. And then all the after meals, the breakfast and the other parties and the disco and what have you. And this all goes on for some time. This all goes on throughout the week. And it's interesting, Samson seems low on real friends, and that becomes less and less surprising as the story goes on. I guess most of us wouldn't use Samson as a friend. But he's assigned some Philistine friends for the feast in verse 11. And Samson, the Hebrew says, riddles them a riddle. He tells them a riddle, and he makes a bet. Get my riddle right, and I'll get you a new set of clothes each. Get it wrong, and each of you will get me a new set of clothes. One each, that's 30 sets of clothes. And the riddle is in verse 14. Out of the eater, something to eat. Out of the strong, something sweet. And of course, we know the answer, because we know what's just happened with the lion. And you get a bit of Samson's character here, don't we? It's just childish. He's promised by God. He's got this super strength, but he's a spoilt brat, still a bit childish. And here's the problem with borrowed friends as well. They haven't chosen him particularly as a friend. They haven't grown up with him. And they don't like being outwitted. And so in verse 15, on the fourth day, they said to Samson's wife, coax your husband into explaining the riddle for us, or we will burn you in your father's household to death. Did you invite us here to rob us? That's pretty menacing, isn't it? They just turn up and say, you know, how's the insurance policy? Have you checked your wiring lately? You know, there could be some accidents about to happen. And they threaten her. So Samson's wife starts to ask him, and she cries and she moans to him, and she seems not to have told Samson the seriousness of the situation she's in. I mean, I could imagine if I'd done something silly like Samson, and someone threatened Glad in that way, that she would say, "Yeah, I know it all seemed like a good idea at the time, but it's kind of backfired a bit. Can we do something to avert some kind of catastrophe?" But she doesn't do that. Says something about their relationship, but she just whinges to him until he submits. And remember that as well. That's not the last time that happens to Samson. It seems that Samson is pathologically incapable of learning a lesson. And that becomes clear over the next couple of weeks. And he isn't the last in the church like that, is he? Yeah, that we've seen that he's learned something from God about his strength, but he's still doing what's right in his own eyes. He's still doing all kinds of silly things. He gives up the secret, so his wife is now safe. Although next week, in the start of chapter 15, we see that they carried out that threat on her anyway. And she and her dad end up being killed horribly. But for now, you think it's the end of the game. They have their answer. So in verse 18, they say to him, "What is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion?" And Samson said to them, "If you had not ploughed with my heifer, you would have not solved my riddle." Well, if you got a secret about me off of Glad, I don't think I would refer to her as a heifer. It's not usually a compliment for your wife or anyone else you know. God comes on Samson then in great strength. Samson is a desperate character. He falls for the wrong women and he keeps on doing it. It's not like he went, "Right, I've learned my lesson about Philistine women." He does it another two more times in the next chapters, and he's easily manipulated by them. And there's a warning here for us, not just the obvious thing about relationships outside the covenant community and about being manipulated by other people because you've been led by your eyes or by something else, but more generally, we fail and sin. We all do that. Learn from it. Learn from our failings rather than just go, "Right, and do it again." Samson repeats this mistake two more times. Then on the second time he repeats it, so the third time he does this, he's repeatedly manipulated and it costs him his life. And you just think, "You idiot." But I think that's the point of why Samson's here for us. While you're thinking, "You idiot," a mirror's held up and go, "Oh, are you that different, are you?" We make the same, not just mistakes, but sins again and again. They get us and you just think, "Perhaps now's time to change." At the very least, be aware of your weaknesses and then do something about them to avoid them. So sometimes, you know, the Oscar Wilde thing, "I can resist anything except temptation." Well, then remove that temptation. Once you know it's tempting, do something to remove the temptation. Take yourself out of the situation. I was told once by someone, there are three things that bring men down as Christians. Gold, girls and grog, or loot, ladies, and liquor. So the three G's or the three L's. And once a guy came to me who was struggling with his faith, and I mentioned that to him, and he looked at me blank and said, "Well, I don't have any problem with grog or gold." And another said to me, when I mentioned the same three G's, he said his problem was guys rather than girls. But I knew a minister who could be extremely critical of other people's and their failings, and he was very critical of younger guys who... he had a lot of young men in his congregation, so he was very critical of men who'd looked at porn or showed any weakness in the area of girls. And he was, if they had any gay feelings, he was, "Yeah, I just wouldn't want to be a gay person in his congregation." And as I got to know him a bit, it turned out that he'd had his hand in the till. He'd been manipulating his church to get money out of them. He may not understand why some men were so weak in some areas when it comes to things like looking at women who are not their wife. But most of us can manage to not steal from a church and lie to people to get money out of them. So we all have different weaknesses. And my weakness is not yours and vice versa. And once we've fallen, then we need to repent from what we've done and learn and then avoid it, especially if they're the three G's or the three L's. But God is sovereign. So that's true from our perspective. So far, the chapter has exposed God's strength and Samson's weakness. But the first secret is overarching this whole chapter, in fact, the whole next two chapters as well. Verse 4 again. His parents did not know that this was from the Lord, who was seeking an occasion to confront the Philistines. So God uses even people's sin in outworking his plan. And now his plan comes into action. It's not an end here, it's going to go right the way through to chapter 16. In fact, in some ways it goes right the way through to the end of the Bible. And that's God's unlikely salvation in verses 19 to 20. The chapter starts by letting us in on a secret, and everyone else is playing catch up, and we can enjoy the story going, well, we actually know what's going on here. Samson's Philistine friends, in inverted commas, have a secret. They've threatened and pressured his wife. He doesn't know that. That's how they worked out his secret, his riddle. And Samson doesn't know. I mean, Samson obviously, I think I'd be surprised if someone threatened my family with death, but you'd sort of know when you can get away with things with people. So he's obviously a really bad judge of character with his so-called friends. Samson doesn't know that they've done this. They know. And he knows that it's impossible to find out his riddle without pestering his wife and threatening her. And so he flies into this rage. So notice that pattern is mentioned at the start. Samson causes the Philistines an annoyance. He's going to get a load of clothes off of them. They don't want to do that. So they try to stop him by threatening his wife. But it hasn't stopped him. It now backfires on them horribly. They don't want Samson to impoverish them. But what does Samson do? Well, he doesn't get out his credit card and go to Debenhams to buy them all a set of clothes. Instead, verses 19 to 20 happens. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon him in power. He went down to Ashkelon, struck down 30 of their men, stripped them of their belongings, and gave them their clothes to those who had been explained the riddle. Burning with anger, he went up to his father's house. And Samson's wife was given to the friend who had attended him at his wedding. Now, it's hard to put all this together, really. We see Samson, and we see he's far from perfect, and yet God uses this to bring about his purposes. But here, the Spirit of the Lord comes on Samson. So it's not just that he went into a bit of a rage. God is right behind these events. The Spirit is coming on him to give him the strength to do this. And maybe you feel uncomfortable with that. In fact, in some ways I do. But there it is. And we need to remember, we're not going through Chelmsford High Street in this chapter, but we're going through the Philistines, actively opposing God's people. They're not innocent bystanders that he's running through the high street killing. These are the people who are causing the problem for Israel he's going through killing. This is what God was proving to Samson with the lion. And he's saying, now use that power. And this is what the chapter has been about. And now the secret of verse 4 is no longer a secret. It's open to everyone. Now, often Christians want to sanitize these bits of Judges, perhaps by just not reading them, or to say it's all about Samson's character. Well, certainly Samson comes across weaker and weaker each chapter. But the text is very clear. The Spirit came upon him. Verse 4, God is looking for an opportunity to confront the Philistines. God's salvation, God's rescue, isn't given a use certificate. It's not cleaned up for us so that we find it acceptable. Remember, it's a salvation from a mess. It's a salvation from a brutal oppression that needs dealing with. And so God's solution is going to be messy too. And that's true when we come to the New Testament. People are opposed to God and his people, and a salvation is offered. God's grace and mercy is unmeasurable, but eventually time will be called and God's wrath will be poured out. And the cross is a reminder of both mercy and wrath. Wrath has been poured out on one already so that we can avoid it. So this chapter is about God's secret, but by the end it's being opened out. Similarly, God's secret now, we're party to it in part. Other bits are concealed from us and others are concealed from this secret. But as we thought about at the start, at times it seems obvious what God is doing, other times not. Sometimes with hindsight we can see what he was doing, other times we still can't. God works secretly and surprisingly, but he is at work, and that is beyond dispute. What we need to do is accept that things just aren't tidy. Now, if you were here on Thursday night, we were looking at tools for handling the Bible, and we looked at something that can things that get in the way of us reading the Bible. And we thought of it's easy to remember brie, as in the cheese brie. And that's the Bible, reason, institution or tradition, but it doesn't spell brie then, and experience. And we all have those. We all have our Bibles, we all have our reason, we all have our traditions, and we all have experience. But sometimes we don't interpret our traditions, our experience, our reason through the Bible, but we reread the Bible through one of those. So some Christians accept that things aren't tidy, as we've just said. Experience tells them that. And so they project that back into the Bible, and then theology becomes untidy, and they're afraid of tidy, precise theology because life's untidy, isn't it? Others like to be very sound. They're very, very sound, and the Bible's God's word, and that's as straightforward as anything, isn't it? But then they're completely thrown by life being untidy. When their experience says things aren't always that straightforward, they then go, what do I do with the Bible? Or they don't understand, or maybe I'm not a proper Christian. But actually, in the Bible, the biblical expectation is God has a plan, but life is untidy. We can be precise about what he has told us, but we can be equally precise that he's not told us everything. We know where he's going, but we don't always know how he's getting there. I'll give you an example from World War II. Hitler signed a pact with Yugoslavia, but then there was a coup in Yugoslavia, and they changed their stance. They decided to keep a non-aggressive pact with the Nazis, but not to help them in any way. And so Hitler launched what was called Operation Punishment. Belgrade was flattened, and 17,000 civilians died. You could say it was a victory for Hitler. Except that while he was doing Operation Punishment in Yugoslavia, it delayed his invasion of Russia. So he didn't make enough progress before winter struck. Ultimately, that and the fact he stretched in North Africa meant there were massive casualties, and it was the beginning of the end of their campaign. It massively backfired on Hitler. And that's what happens in the Samson narrative, isn't it? The Philistines keep on having these plans, and it looks like he's going somewhere, but it backfires through this oversexed oaf called Samson. God uses unexpected and at times messy things to bring about the beautiful thing that he's doing. So we're to trust, and trust in the outcome. Obey according to what we know from God, but then leave the detail, which is out of our control, to him. I can obey God's word. I can do what I'm doing now and call you to do that, but I can't make you do that. That's between you and God. And the detail of what you do with that, from my perspective, well, I have to leave that to God and what he's going to do with that. Also, notice what a small salvation this is in verse 19. Only 30 men. They're being oppressed by the Philistines. Really, what does going down to the shopping centre and killing 30 Philistines really achieve? Really, what's the point of all this? Well, the point in chapter 14 is that it's a start. It says that he will start to deliver them. The next few chapters, which builds up to the climax of chapter 16, something much bigger happens. But back to where we started is those who give God thanks for small mercies, like that elderly couple. The wife learned to drive later in life. And it's amazing that someone who's gone through all that gives God thanks for such a small mercy. People who've had an awful bereavement often see God's hand in small detail. And when we look at our own town, we're overwhelmed by the task that we have to reach them with the gospel. And yet we can give God thanks that from time to time, a few people here and a few people there have come to faith in Christ. And we trust that something like that is happening in other churches. What is God doing? Well, on the big scale, we know the answer. It's there in the Bible. He's maturing his church, and he's bringing everything ultimately under Christ. The detail, we have no idea. And that's how he works. What's revealed is for us and our children, but the secret things belong to the Lord. And you get the impression that that's the end of this bit in chapter 14. That's the end of what else we've got to say about Samson. Four times Samson, it says Samson goes down. Verse 19, he goes up, and the riddle is answered, 30 Philistines die, the end. But verse 30 leaves it open for a sequel. Sorry, verse 20 leaves it open for a sequel. And Samson's wife was given to the friend who had attended him at his wedding. Samson doesn't look very happy about his wife, and so she's married off to the best man. And you kind of think, is he going to leave it there? A more complete salvation is on its way. This, chapter 14, is just a taster. And for where this is going, for the rest, we need chapters 15 and 16, which you'll have to come back for over the next couple of weeks. Let's pray. Lord God, we learned last week that you are amazingly gracious, but you also work as an awesome mystery. Please help us to accept the fact that much of the work that you do is secret from us, that we don't understand your ways, but we can trust you because of what you've told us about your plan ultimately and what you demand from us. So please help us to just obey what we do know and to leave the secret things with you. Amen.